the show.
Hey everyone, we are back for the second half of the Best of the Boundless show in 2010. Hopefully you had a great Christmas with your family and your friends, wherever you are, northern or southern hemisphere, cold or warm weather. We love you all. So we're going to feature a few more of your clips this week. As you know, we kicked it off last week with Dave Sockheld's favorite clip. And this week, we're going to kick it off with my favorite clip, which is actually a rather recent one. Many of you commented on this show as well. You enjoyed it. You learned a lot from it. It is my own friends, Aaron and Blythe Hunt. It was one of those shows where I sat in the studio with them. And as we talked, especially near the end, and when we'll play just a sampling of that, I really sat there and I was like, this is some stuff that I haven't heard maybe said in this way before. And it was something that I ruminated on for a few days afterwards. And so, you know, sometimes you can get into this biz and you can start doing these shows and feel like you've heard it all and maybe said it all yourself. But that was one of those situations where I was like, wow, you know, I really appreciate what they had to say. And I loved Aaron's honesty about his list and just about all of his expectations and Blythe and how she had to deal with that and her own kind of prejudices against him. So it's kind of our own little Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet story. It's a fun one. And so that is my favorite clip. We will kick off with that and then move into some more reflections on 2010. Here you go.
My job was to get him to the party. And so I went to his house to pick him up. And I gave him his birthday present, which made him cry. And I just thought he was a sensitive emo type artist. And he went upstairs to get ready, and it took him forever to come back down. Forever, like a half an hour. And this is a surprise party, and I knew people were waiting. So he comes down, and I can hear him coming, so I run to the front door so we can leave immediately. And he stops on the stairs, and he says, "Can we talk?" And I was like, okay. You know, hoping that he would make it really quick. And he said to me, verbatim, because I also remember this, he looked at me and he said, "Do you think that you could ever like me?" And I started laughing again.
It's true. It's true. She did laugh.
One of the first conversations we had, which is another conversation for another day, but it was about date to mate. And he was very much into the next woman I date, I'm going to marry. I date with intention, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I date to get to know people so that I can know what I'm looking for and et cetera, et cetera. So I knew when he said that he was interested in pursuing a dating relationship, I knew what that meant and that he was looking at marriage. So it freaked me out. So I laughed and I said, can I think about it?
At which point I was completely convinced, oh my, I am the biggest idiot on the face of the planet. This whole time I have thought, oh, she's madly in love with me. Of course she'll say yes. Oh, I've got this in the bag. And then she, and I'm, oh, you know, the record player stops and grinds to a halt. And suddenly, oh, reality sets in. It's not about me. So we do talk about it. And between the birthday party and talking about it, I am praying madly and just with all kinds of fervor to the Lord, please, please, please don't let her ask why this sudden change of heart, because I have no idea. And so, of course, when we sit down to talk, she says, well, I think I've made up my mind, but I have one question, why? And, you know, I just, oh my, I'm sure I looked like a deer caught in headlights, but I had basically hemmed and hawed for an hour and a half and got around to, well, this is what I was thinking the other day when I was praying. You know, I don't really trust these guys. I don't think they're good for you. I think I could do a better job taking care of you. And, well, let's spiritualize it. Okay, I think this is God's plan for my life.
And you also said that you could not imagine that we had spent all of that time together.
Yes.
Getting to know each other, becoming so close, to sit at each other's weddings and watch each other walk down the aisle with somebody else.
Right. Yeah. Because though I was in some alternate universe and able to just hang out with this girl for hours on end and be okay with it, at the same time, I understood that God doesn't bring relationships into our lives for trivial reasons. It's not just, you know, us bumping together in the cosmos. He has purpose behind our relationships. And so the thought of watching her walk down the aisle with some other guy, I was like, yeah, that's not happening. So that was definitely a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I mean, I think it's good to note too, how you were saying, you know, it was a point where you felt God spoke to you and you had to stop and listen. I mean, I think a lot of people could blow something like that off or could be all crazy, or there are a lot of fears, you know, that could cause you to say, you know, oh, you know, to have to dismiss something or whatever. But you actually, I mean, that's not a, you know, it's not, like I said, at the front end of the show, it's not a normal occurrence, or it's not a normal situation. So I think a lot of guys could be like, oh my goodness, that's so crazy, you know, that's great, you know, obviously I'm just going to meet someone and the stars are going to align and then I'll know, you know, then it'll be like whatever, but this story is too weird or whatever. Yeah. So I think it's notable, you know, that you listened and that you said, you know, in the midst of something that was probably very scary, you said, well, I'm going to have to do something about this. So
yeah.
So that's good. How did you reconcile all of that? I mean, basically you're admitting, okay, we'd spent too much time together. You knew she was a believer, so that was good. Now you obviously knew a lot more about her, but you know, you kind of had your list, which at this point you kind of had to chuck because, you know,
right.
I don't know. Did you check out her eyebrows? I mean, how did that go down? I mean,
no, it really was, my relational past was extremely haphazard and just ridiculous. And I never really was deliberate about anything. It was just kind of whatever happens. And so this was the first relationship where I said, okay, I'm going to do this. This is deliberately moving towards marriage unless I hear otherwise, you know, unless God closes the doors, this is where this is leading. And this is crazy, but I'm going to step out in faith. Mm-hmm. And the list really had to go out the window because I saw the list as only working within that just on a whim relationship kind of stuff. It didn't, in practical terms, that list never guaranteed me someone that I would get along well with, that I would converse well with, that I would have things in common with. That was just totally in line with my personal preference, which the further our relationship went, the more I began to see it was totally ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, I had guys in my life when I did freak out and say, what in the world is going on? They had the grace and had the knowledge to say, well, look, quit clowning around. You need to move forward with this and be serious and act like an adult and move towards marriage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so which obviously begs the question, which I'm sure all the women out there are asking, okay, how then did you reconcile the attraction issue? And Blythe, how did you deal with him now saying, I want to be in a relationship with you? And you're like, what am I, like a last resort? You know, you just, you know, like, now do you just feel you have to make up for lost time because we spent all this time together, so now you have to like do something about it or whatever. So how did that play out?
Yeah, well, it was an issue for sure. We had quirky things. You know, I told her I loved her and she said, well, I'd really love to reciprocate that, but I don't have those feelings. And we went to pick out rings before she had said, I love you. And it ended up being a lot more of just trusting that God knew what he was doing rather than relying on my personal feelings. And I knew I had enough relational baggage that I knew my personal feelings weren't to be trusted anyway. I guess that's the best way to put that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there wasn't this disappointment that I had somehow missed out on Mrs. Wright. It was more, well, God's doing something. I'm not sure what, but I'm going to move this direction until he tells me otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, was there a point then where you knew that attraction had grown, or because you were talking about feelings, not trusting your feelings, but,
right,
you know, I'm sure Blythe didn't want to walk down the aisle with you saying like, I don't even know if he's attracted to me. Does he just feel like this is his next assignment from the Lord and I'm the subject of it? Or, you know, because no girl wants that to be her story.
Right. Well, it did. It was a progression, and it was kind of like what Lewis talks about in some of his writings, where sometimes you just have to just kind of beat yourself into submission and just do what you know is right and pray that God will bring the rest of you along. And that really was what it came down to for me, was stepping out in faith and just moving forward, because I was scared to death to get married. I didn't want to get married. I mean, I could barely hold down a job. I was actually unemployed when we got engaged. What is this marriage thing about? So it really was about trusting God and just taking little steps of faith. I mean, baby steps of faith, trusting that he knew what he was doing and that he was going to provide, all the while praying for feelings to come along. And they finally did. It wasn't, it certainly wasn't immediate. It was a process. Thankfully a short process, but mm-hmm. it was a process.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that he had mentioned when we were friends was that he doesn't like curly hair, or he didn't like curly hair. And I have curly hair and I can't do anything about it. And that was a big hang up for me. I was like, oh, but he'll never think I'm pretty because I have curly hair. And then my little sister told me, that when you love someone, they become your ideal. So mm-hmm. she said, he will love curly hair because you have curly hair, and no other woman can match up to you because he loves you. But it did take me a while to have those feelings for him because of those conversations we had had, and I wanted to guard my heart. So when he said that he wanted to pursue a relationship, I called Lisa, I called you, and I called other friends and my brother, and they all said, this is a godly man who is pursuing you in a godly way, and you need to respond to that. And so finally I called Erica Counts, our pastor's wife, and she raised her voice at me. And that basically just scared me into going back to him and saying, okay, I'll give this a try. And I told him, I said, I don't have those feelings for you, but I'll give it a shot.
Yeah. I remember having that conversation. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. Yeah.
So you were on his side.
I was on his side. I don't think I'd fully understood the list at that point. Otherwise, I maybe would have given you a little more grace. That is crazy. That is crazy. Please check him out, or at least hire a private investigator. But that was okay. God was in it. So one other caveat here then, because I think one of the things, Alyssa, you were asking was just the whole idea of, okay, you know, do you sit down? I mean, there are obviously processes and there are stories, and with you, it kind of worked out in relationship and through a friendship and stuff like that. But, you know, we have people that listen to Boundless who either get into relationships that are bad because they get caught up in all the emotion, and then other, you know, things go by the wayside that very much should be considered. Or we have people that way overanalyze something and they're just in this inertia and they're completely paralyzed and, you know, heading towards 50 and still single because they can't get anything to happen because they've got this ideal in their head or whatever. How would you speak, and Alyssa, clarify this question if you want to a little bit, but how would you guys speak to the whole, you know, what is non-negotiable, and how do you get that out in the open and make that clear and realize I can build a life with this person and Christ is going to be the center and XYZ versus getting past all the non-negotiables and kind of navigating a relationship in the midst of that?
Yeah. And when you're saying, like, when you choose to love someone, they become the ideal. And I guess the thing for me is that it's kind of tricky to find that balance when you're dating someone of like, this is absolutely who the Lord has called me to right now, or sometimes we kind of misinterpret what the Lord is saying to us. And so I guess kind of how did you guys balance between what the Lord was saying to you and just hoping and praying that that was accurate and that actually was the Lord speaking to you, and also knowing, like, we're not married, and so this might not be the one for me, like, this may not be, kind of how did you balance that with what your expectations were of who you were going to marry, and also just knowing you were not yet married, and so they didn't have to be the ideal yet.
I think for me, I always had previous relationships. I always had gone in waiting for them to fail. And this was the first relationship that I went into waiting for it to succeed. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have that expectation of, well, any minute now the wheels are going to fall off. It was more an expectation of, if this isn't of God, he's going to put a stop to it. And I can't say enough about the need to be in relationship with older people that have more life experience, that have more Christian life experience, that can speak into your life, that you allow to speak into your life, that know you well, that can give you that kind of guidance. Because it's never supposed to be on your own. And it, you know, God didn't build us to be on our own, and he didn't build us to be in relational struggle on our own. He didn't build us to be in spiritual struggle on our own. He built it as a network of his body. So if we exclude ourselves, I think oftentimes in my past, I would be dating a girl and I'd do the fade from church. You know, I would fade from the rest of my network and just disappear for a while. And that's, nothing healthy comes of that, because then no one knows who you're dating. They don't know the atmosphere around your dating. They just don't have a way to access you and be able to speak truth to you. So I would say to that if you're, you know, if you are constantly overanalyzing, or if you are obsessing about the one, that's waiting for failure. That's asking for failure rather than trusting the promises of God and looking to his goodness and his truth and what he's doing in our lives. Because he certainly is not at the helm waiting for failure. He's at the helm creating redemption. And it changes your entire relational perspective when that's your focus.
What's up, Lisa? This is Angelina from East Bay, California, calling, checking in. I just wanted to thank you all so much for another great year of podcasts. I just look forward to listening every week. I really love the Lecrae episode because I love me some hip hop, but I think most of all, I really loved the I'll Go Out With You If and the counterpart, like I'll Ask You Out, with the guys first talking and the girls responding, just kind of getting an inkling in the guy's mind what they're thinking and when they're just in the girl, and then the counterpart with the girl responding back. And I just appreciate your insight and just to making sure people date according to like a biblical model, and just encouraging everyone to get it done. Thank you again so much, and hope you have a wonderful Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Ideal scenario with a guy who, let's say, you know him, maybe he's relatively new to your circle of friends, newer to your church or whatever, and you think, hey, he seems like a cool guy. What would you hope would happen?
I would hope that he would come up, if he's interested, that it wouldn't just be like, hey, let's hang out. If he's interested and wants to get to know me better, hanging out is so vague. Mm-hmm. If he wants to ask me out on a date, say the word date, not right. Hey, let's just hang out, because it's very vague. Right. Am I paying for dinner? Are you paying for dinner? What does hanging out constitute? You know, if your intention is,
well, if it's odds are I'll be paying for dinner. I
mean, let's just be with honest. A gift card. But, but you know, to be upfront, and I know that's really scary for men. Just listening to the podcast last week, it can be intimidating. But there needs to be some sort of definition in the beginning, because women have incredible imaginations, and we take hanging out to mean 18 different things.
Yeah. Someone on Facebook said that too. She said, call it a date. I would love for you to just call it a date, so I know where we stand and I know how to approach that, because the hanging out thing is too nebulous. Go ahead, Kristen.
Well, along with that, I just think, like you said, Carrie, that there has to be
or that I would appreciate that intentionality of the guy taking the leadership role and not making it a huge pressure thing, but just being really clear about asking me if I would be interested in getting together and going to dinner or lunch and calling it a date, or just being really intentional to let me know what he was thinking about things. Because I know from talking with girlfriends that it's so easy, like you said, Carrie, girls can run with things and just be like, oh, is this a date? Is it not? And overanalyze and start thinking about things. Mm-hmm. And so it just makes things a lot easier if you just say, hey, let's go on a date, and then can move forward with stuff.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that, you know, for all the guys out there, that I think that if he's single and she's single and he likes her and he has peace from God and he's praying about it and feels like God's leading him that way, he should take the risk and ask her out. And I think girls really appreciate that bold act and just the directness. I know for me, with being asked out, first of all, I hope it happens. And second of all, I know we talked about how some guys are vague. They can say, come over to my house for a group thing, and you don't know, do they really just like me as a friend, as part of the big group, or are they interested in me? Mm-hmm. And that's why they're bringing me to the group, so they can get to know me more. Mm-hmm. So guys operate differently. So sometimes I may mean it as, no, I just want to hang out as a friend in the group, if they ask me that way. And other times it's, no, I'm interested in you.
Right.
And that's why I want to come and hang out, so I get to know you better.
Well, and that totally bugs a lot of women, because you'll see when I put the shout out, that's what a lot of women will do to say that they are interested in a guy. Like, they will try to invite them to a group thing, maybe if they're hosting at their house, just to have that context of getting mm-hmm. to know them. Guys, do not play the ladies game, okay? I mean, it's kind of like this. Seriously, like, how many pizza parties do we have to go to for 6-12 months before you finally say, you know what, maybe I do want to get to know you as an individual.
Yeah, well,
that's where it has to, there has to be some clarity there, because mm-hmm. Now I do want to bring up my friend Paul mentioned on my page, he was talking about his concern, and he wanted to throw it out to the ladies, of what he calls the swoopers, and the guys who like go to a church singles group or whatever, and within, you know, like say that there's a new girl that comes to the group, and immediately they like ask her out. And then all of a sudden she's like singled out. She hasn't even had a chance to meet any of the women in the group yet. She's already going to go out with this guy. And then, you know, maybe it's all awkward and weird. And then she ends up like moving on to another group. And just these guys that immediately hone in on the new girls. So he was kind of like saying, okay, so are women okay with that? Like, someone you just meet right away, you just ask them out? Or, you know, he was saying, you know, there are girls that I've known, you know, that where it was like a couple years and I didn't think of them that way. And then I finally asked them out or whatever. And I don't know, is there a happy medium on that?
I'm all right with a guy asking me out right away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I don't mind knowing right away, oh, he's interested in me and he likes me. Mm-hmm. So that's okay with me.
Yeah. Okay. Any of the other two?
I might feel a little bit more comfortable getting to know someone in a group at first, mm-hmm. but that's just my personality. Mm-hmm. And after a couple of times of getting to hang out in a group, then I would definitely say that I would appreciate someone being willing to step up and breach that friend group pizza hangout barrier.
Right. Though you will end up in the that makes you more likely to end up in the, you know, you get to know him in the context of a group, know that you're not interested in him then. And then when he does ask you out, then you're going to be stuck in the position of having to turn him down or go out with him, either one of those ways. So it does kind of go both ways. I do see that. But it can be tricky. But if you're OK with saying, you know what, I have gotten to know you in this context and I just don't think we'd be a great fit, you know.
And if a guy does ask you out right away and you want to get to know him more, you can tell him that, well, you know, I am interested, but I'd really like to hang out with you more and get to know you more in a group setting.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
I think it boils down to personality mm-hmm. with women. I think there are some of us who are very outgoing and really love getting to know people. And so if a man were to approach me and say, hey, you look fun, I would like to get to know you, would you like to go out with me? I'd say yes, because I don't ever see it as a wrong opportunity to get to know somebody. Mm-hmm. But I think there are women like Kristen who, you know, are more tentative and just say, hey, you know, that's, you know, it's, thank you for that, but I need a little bit more time. And so, unfortunately, maybe it kind of falls on the men a little bit to be a little bit astute and mm-hmm. observant mm-hmm. of kind of the women in their circle. And and that is part of the process of just getting to know people in general. That's not specific to dating relationships. It's it's people in general. So.
Right. Definitely. And I would just add that, you know, if you really like a guy, then it doesn't really matter so much how he asks you out. You just want to spend time with him, and you're just glad that he's giving you opportunity to spend time with him.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely. Well, want to land on that for a second, because there were a couple women on the on Facebook who said two things. One, like two women said that they don't say yes to a guy that they barely know, which I kind of disagree with. So I would kind of land with Carrie on that. Now, I mean, I want to know that he's a believer, you know, for the most part. And I want to know maybe, you know, a couple things about him. But that for me is the purpose of going on a date. And I mean, if I don't know him, yeah, I'm not going to go on a night hike with him, but I will go and meet him somewhere. Okay.
Right,
I mean, there's
wisdom.
Nothing wrong with meeting someone. I meet people in the mall. I mean, I talk to people. So, I mean, I kind of disagree with that. I think that's putting a few too many strictures on guys that's going to freak them out. The other thing that I didn't really agree with, not necessarily that was said on Facebook, was the women that insist that the guy asks them out in person. I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm like, especially if you know the guy, I mean, I just want it to be natural and casual and honest and direct. And again, that we know it is a date. Now, maybe not a text or something weird or some weird, you know, like
an email.
Facebook. Well, yeah. I mean, but I'm fine with I wouldn't be if it was someone I knew. OK. And they just shot me an email and said, hey, would you want to go out Friday night? I'm okay with that. I use email for a ton of stuff nowadays.
Yeah. I think it totally depends, because I know I've had friends who have been asked out in person and it's been totally weird because of the way the guy asked.
Right.
And I've had friends where a guy, the only way he could communicate was through Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so he totally confidently and in a totally tactful way just messaged her and it worked out great because he was intentional.
Right.
And he took the opportunities he had.
And not hedging around, not using Facebook as like a mask or as a front for something. Mm-hmm. And I will say one way that is never acceptable, and that is through one of your friends. Do not go send your
friends. No eighth grade asking out, please.
No, none of those MASH things where you're like open up or check the box.
Yeah.
None of that weirdness.
I think a lot of it with women and expectations of how they prefer to be asked out, we have built up in our heads. Women have built up in their heads a lot of times this perfect scenario of when they're going to meet the perfect man and how everything is going to fall into place. And if it doesn't follow the structured list that they have, he will ask me out in person and there will be rose petals and there will be amazingness. Mm-hmm. Then they're super disappointed. And I think that's something that we as women really have to deal with is our expectations and being kind and gracious to our brothers in the Lord and not putting that on them, saying, yes, we want you to be men. We want you to be bold. We want you to be intentional. But cutting them some slack, I think that we kind of look at them and say, you must do X, and yet we don't expect to kind of have to do anything in return. And I think that's where a lot of heartache comes in, even in the beginning of a dating relationship, because it's just not what you expected it would be. And these expectations are dashed, and he has no clue. He has no idea. And so I think that's one way that Christian women can really kind of just examine themselves, examine your expectations. And in the same way that you want this man to respect you and care for you, you have to be willing to want to do the same thing and offer up some grace because it is difficult for men to take that step. And so I think that's something that we can kind of forget in our quest for romance and for love and for wanting to be cared for.
Some ways, I think that I would agree with you, Carrie. And I would encourage women to be more willing to give guys a chance who do pursue. Mm-hmm. I think that oftentimes if there are the neat foundations in place in terms of character and seeming to love the Lord, that's a foundation for if a guy confidently asks you out, to be willing to say yes versus having this whole checklist of things that have to be in place. Because I think sometimes that we as women can put too much pressure on one date instead of seeing it as an opportunity to get to know someone better and an opportunity to move forward with something.
Right.
We'll
because
turn a
it is
guy
a
down.
Date. Yeah.
It's not a date.
I mean, I think a lot of women think that if they go out with someone and they're just not immediately head over heels for them, then, well, it wasn't a success. And obviously I failed. And obviously it's just not a good fit. And now I'm just all like, should I even talk to him?
Yeah.
You know, and they just get all crazy.
My favorite part of this year's podcast was the adoption podcast, specifically the interview with Reggie Hamm, where he's talking about how God kind of gave him the 2x4 smack to the head about not being able to control your life. I just had a baby this past year, and nothing makes that more apparent of not being able to control your life like having children. And so when I struggle with scheduling or things not going the way I plan or even worrying about the future with her, I'm reminded of that interview, and it gives me a lot of comfort knowing that even though I can't be in control, that God is in control and part of our stories. Love the show.
Every lie I've ever spoken that left me bruised and broken, every dream I thought would save me, just a scar the cold world gave me, every plan I hoped would lift me, that I just let shape and shift me, every fear that keeps me tethered to everything I've weathered. Set it on fire, set it on fire, and in those little flames till nothing remains but you, just you. Set it on fire, set it on fire, burn it down to the ground till nothing is found but you.
Hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am in the studio with Reggie Hamm. Reggie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lisa.
Great to have you. Reggie is here for our chapel this week, or our monthly chapel, I guess I should say. Very privileged to have him. You guys probably know him without knowing him, so this is kind of exciting. Reggie has penned more than 20 number one hits. A longtime songwriter, artist, producer, and most known probably in the general sphere of life for your single Time of My Life, which was at number one for a long, long time, David Cook having recorded it. And let's just launch into that really quickly, Reggie. Okay. You wrote that song. Your wife basically asked you to write it, asked you to enter the American Idol songwriting competition in 2008. Right. And what was your first reaction to that?
Well, first reaction was she'd never asked me to write a song before in, you know, in 17 years of marriage. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of took me back a little bit. And the second reaction was, just for a split second, I thought, well, I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't know about entering a contest now, you know. And
yeah.
I didn't even know how you do that. And
because yeah. you've written for Clay Cross.
Yeah, I'd written for, you know, I don't know how many people, but Clay Cross,
including the Gaithers. Yeah. I have to throw that out there because I love them. Gaither
yeah,
Vocal Band.
Yeah, I have a song on the Gaither Vocal Band record once. And
love them.
And Kenny Loggins and Maxie Priest and Bob Carlisle and Mercy Me. And, you know, there's a list of people that I've written for. And so I just thought, I felt like that it was, for a split second there, I just thought, well, that's for people who are amateurs. But then I didn't have anything going on, and you mentioned the book Angels and Idols, and I go into what had happened in my life, and I was in a very dark place and a very down place and had not had any success in a while, and I had nothing to lose, mm-hmm. basically. So I honored her request, and I had a week left before the contest deadline was up, so I gave it a shot.
Yeah, and there were 40,000 entries.
They tell me there were 40 plus thousand entries. I'm not exactly sure how many, but
okay.
over 40,000.
A lot by angst-filled teenage girls, no doubt.
Quite certain, yeah.
So you at least maybe rose to the top with a little bit of experience in that, so that was good. So obviously, David Cook recorded the song. It ended up being played at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Oprah referenced it when she did her Olympic show. Very cool. But you have got a backstory to this, and I want to talk about this because our theme for the show this week is actually adoption.
Mm-hmm.
It is National Adoption Month
right.
this month. We at Boundless are very passionate about adoption. In fact, because even yeah. the fact that we're mostly single in our audience, we're trying to share with one another as a community that adoption has a place for singles as well in supporting mm-hmm. families who are adoptive. In as you're sitting down, moving towards marriage, talking with your boyfriend, girlfriend, you better put it on the table whether or not you're going to be open to adopting kids and what God has, you know, in that for you. So it's a conversation that we're
we're all having. Tell us a little bit about, because your parents, you and your wife Yolanda, are parents of two kids, and you went to China actually to get your daughter and came back from China and realized that she has actually a very rare genetic disease.
Yeah, we were handed a little girl with probably one of the rarest genetic disorders on the planet. She's missing a piece of her 15th maternal chromosome. It's called Angelman syndrome. And it's incurable, and she'll be the way she is for life. She doesn't speak. A lot of angels, they call them angels, and I think with good reason. But a lot of angels don't walk. She does. She actually runs. In fact, I call her my cardio because she runs all over the place. But they have seizure disorders and sleeping disorders, and she didn't sleep a full night for the first 4 years of her life. She slept a couple hours at a time and then be up for 20 hours and whatever, you know. And so devastating. It's a it's devastating to raise an angel. It's a very difficult thing to do. And it took my wife and I, you know, out of our way, out of our comfort zone. And sometimes it still does. You know, it's a real commitment, and it's a full-time thing. And we also have a son who was adopted in 2006, and he is perfect and beautiful and amazing and a rock star. And he takes us out of our comfort zone every day, too. So.
Exactly. Just in different ways.
That's right.
Just in different ways.
Don't jump off the couch again, you know what I mean, in those ways. Don't get up there on the mantle. You can't. No, don't do that.
Yeah,
you know,
so. Yeah. Well, and it wasn't like you needed, you know, it wasn't like you're like, Lord, can you please send some kind of trial into my life? Because definitely I need something going on. I mean, you had gone... I think it was when you had gone over to adopt Isabella, right? That you had a rising, you had a single that was rising on the charts?
Yeah, I had left the career being just a writer and had gotten an artist record deal as an artist with Universal Records, and had a pop record out. And that single was at 15 with a bullet when I was going to China, when I got on the plane to go to China. And so, you know, things looked like they were great, and the world was my oyster, as they say. And when I got back, the single had died, and all my tour dates had canceled with all the cool rock bands. And not only that, Reg, but you have a little girl with the world's rarest genetic disorder. So you don't have a career anymore, and you got to take care of this little girl. And so my wife and I went into... we went into a mode that we had no idea we could go into. And... so it really tested our faith. It tested our stamina, our physical ability, just everything, you know.
Yeah, because I think most, you know, most musicians, especially when they enter, you know, the mainstream, it's kind of like, I mean, it seems totally nuts that you would go on a trip and come back and they're already telling you, you know, you're just done. I mean, it's just...
in three weeks.
That's totally nuts. Like, most people don't... if you're an accountant, you kind of... right. Your career does not generally play
out
like that. So
if they hire you, you know, at the beginning of November...
right.
They very rarely fire you at the end of November.
Right.
But it happens all the time.
When you're not even there to merit firing. I mean, that's just like nuts. Okay. So you were already having to deal with that. Then you're dealing with, you know, your daughter having a genetic disorder. And then you kind of come into this period where, okay, so you wrote the song, and but you're still having to live life. You still are living life as you know it and as a family and reconciling, you know, this is kind of our normal. How are you now able to encourage families in the midst of all this, especially those in, you know, who are adoptive families? Because it's not, I mean, there's not just the challenge of we're adopting a child with special needs. I mean, we know that many adoptive families take in kids who are struggling, whether it's with attachment disorders, whether it's with, you know, anger,
there's,
you know,
a lot of that.
Churning around in the foster care system for years. I mean, a lot of families feel probably that they're floundering or that they're not quite sure what they got into. So how can you be a support, or how have you been?
Well, and we have been just really organically, particularly in the special needs community. We get a lot of people. Yolanda gets a lot of phone calls, and I get a lot of phone calls, and I actually refer a lot of people to her because she's a lot more comforting than I am. I can write you a song, and that's about all. But she's a nurturing soul. You know, I think the main thing we tell everybody is to walk forward. And I know that sounds so trite, but sometimes that's all you can do. And I remember there were days when we were just in our darkest days, and I remember the alarm would go off, and I'd been asleep maybe 3 hours. and I'd been up all night with Isabella, and now I've got to get up and get started. And I remember thinking, okay, I got to break this down into literally into minutes. For this minute, I've got to sit upright. Let me see if I can do that. And let's start there. Now let me see if I can actually get my shoes on. Now let me see if I can get to the sink to brush my teeth. Now let me see if I, and it's just, sometimes you have to break it down just to seconds and minutes. And that's what we always encourage people is just take it, you know, in the smallest increments you can. Don't try to bite it all off and chew it all, you know, all on it at the same time. It's take today and just get through today and see what good can happen today. And then maybe string two or three of those days together, and then you've got some positivity going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But never give up on love, because that's all this just sounds so corny. I know people listening are going, oh man, these are just platitudes, but it really is true. And also, I guess for me, you know, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
It might not all be better by Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
It might take a 6 month time period or 8 months or whatever, or in our case it was 5 years before we had a diagnosis of what my daughter had. We didn't know she had Angelman syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So there were five dark years of not knowing and just trying to figure things out. And, you know, it didn't reveal itself over a week or mm-hmm. over a month or over a year. It took 5 years, and sometimes it might take longer than 5 years.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean you can't have some good days in between. You know, cherish the moments that are good,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Well, and I think that's so good, because I think we're so often, and I don't know where it comes from, because it's certainly not from scripture. You know, we preach at ourselves that if we just do the right things, then things are going to fall into place. And if we just do X, Y, Z, if we plug in this formula, then God is going to reward us, or then, you know, life is going to go more smoothly. And if we just make sure we don't mess up, then, but you know what? I mean, life's not like that.
Yeah. And I would probably debate someone who would argue that Jesus said that
mm-hmm.
To anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that God has promised that life will be beautiful
mm-hmm.
and that life is a gift and that life is here for a reason, and that yes, we should all be here, and we're all fellow strugglers in this beautiful life.
Mm-hmm.
But in the midst of beauty is going to be up and down, and some of it's going to be rain, and some of it's going to be sunshine. And it's not, if it's all sunshine all the time, there's no texture,
right?
You know, and I tell writers this, young writers, if you go to a movie and the first act everything's great, and the second act everything's great, and the third act everything's great, that's the worst movie mm-hmm. you've ever seen in your life.
Because mm-hmm.
there's no conflict, and there's no texture, and there's no up and down to it. And so while we don't long for the bad times, sometimes they're necessary to teach us things mm-hmm. and get us to places we need to go.
My favorite episode of The Boundless Show this year was Lisa's interview with Jesse Pohl. It specifically dealt with pornography, but I thought it was one of the best discussions of how we need to understand our sin that I've heard in quite some time. I remember him saying that the law deals with sin from the outside in, but God deals with us from the inside out. And what really struck me was him saying, it's not just enough to want to change, but I really need to hate my sin and to see how offensive it is before God. And that discussion has come back to mind so many times over the year, and just how I act and how I conduct myself and wanting to be pleasing to God. So thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Jesse, for sharing your story.
I'm done giving my heart up, only to be given up. I'm done showing you ways to love me more. How could you forget how? Holding on to say goodbye, I tremble and say, but the baby is still us. Oh yeah. I just need to see if everything was fine, but I found out you didn't want me on your mind. Loving for you is just a game. You forget how we're holding on to say goodbye. I tremble and say, but baby, it's still us. Oh yeah.
I want you to start out, Jesse, by just telling your story. Tell us really the story of kind of your, how you were first introduced to porn and really what transpired as you began to walk that road. I'm sure when you were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, you didn't say, you know, well, at some point, you know, I'll deal with porn and whatever, and I'll just in the right. middle of that right. be serving the Lord. So
right.
obviously there was a little juggernaut or some kind of turn in your story there. So talk to us yeah. about how that all began.
Well, I would say that usually it's not just a, you're not falling off a cliff into looking at porn. Usually for most guys, it comes from, you know, seeing a movie or something like that where a woman's naked. And that was the case for me when I was 11 or 12. Yeah, I was just with some guys. We weren't doing anything, you know, mischievous. We were just hanging out and playing sports. And we ended up watching a movie. And in this particular movie, there was a woman who undressed completely. And that was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I was like, whoa, you know, I don't even know what to do with this. And I honestly don't remember much of it after that, because I think I probably like closed my eyes or something. It was like a bit of a shock. Mm-hmm. And
I remember you saying when you told me about this that you were simultaneously like horrified and amazed, and there was like a battle in you with that. Describe that.
I you know, you come even at 11 and 12 years old, you know, you understand what morality is coming from a Christian home, and you know what's right and wrong. And at 12, you notice girls and that kind of thing. But you definitely have. I had a moral standard that had been set in my life, and you know, I have awesome parents that had set that for me, and I had embraced that myself. And but I think that inside me as a male, visually, it had stimulated something, whatever that something was, and I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. It was like the shot of adrenaline. At the same time, there was immediate shock, because the moment after, I knew that it was something that was not supposed to be. I knew that I was not supposed to be privileged to seeing that outside of my wife. Even though I was 11 and 12, I knew that to be true. Mm-hmm. And so both of those things maybe didn't happen simultaneously, but they happened one right after another for sure. Hmm. After that, I it laid dormant. I can recall that scene on the TV, you know, and it would sort of just come to the surface of my head growing up. But I would say when I was 15 years old, it was like my next episode of dealing with porn. I was on a trip, a soccer trip, and some of the guys were in the hotel room, you know, because we were away from home, and in hotels you can't just watch porn, really. You can go to the adult channels or whatever, and then you would have to buy it or whatever, but you can always like watch a little bit of it or whatever. So the guys were like, oh, you know, come and look at this. And I actually turned them down, and I went into the other room and got made fun of and that kind of thing. And that was a major note for me in my life, because even now I'm so proud of myself as a 14, 15 year old guy to be able to do that. And that victory has stuck in my mind just as that first image stuck in my mind. And I knew even now that it can be done, that victory is attainable if you're focused on the things that are good and right and clean. And so it was really awesome for me to be able to step away from that situation. And then in high school and then in the beginning of college, there were sites starting to pop up that objectified women, not in the fact that it was pornography per se, but they were like comparison sites where there would be pictures of women on these sites, and you could rate them whether they are hot or whether they weren't, or you know, in the middle,
hot or not.
And then you could like click forward, go to the next image, and do the same thing. And honestly, that was the beginning of my desensitization towards, you know, a woman's looks and the way that it stimulated my brain. I could rate these women solely on the fact of what they looked like. And that was sort of like the next step into me falling off the cliff a little bit. Because I was starting to look at women in a different way than I should have been. And I wasn't looking at any nudity necessarily. I mean, some of them were, you know, scantily clad, I suppose you could say, but I mean, it wasn't like I was going into that stuff. But I would say within the next few years, those were the times where I was actually like, even at a Christian college, as a Christian male, with a Christian peer group and all of those things that were, you know, on the outside, wonderful and good and focused on ministry, etc., there was the ability for me to go and get behind the firewall or the filter or whatever they had at school and be able to start looking at images, you know, and images of women that were naked or, you know, in bathing suits and that kind of thing. And it sort of just slid down into, you know, oh, now there's video online, you know, and that kind of thing. And that's where it gets really dangerous, is you fall deeper into this fantasy zone, you know. And I would say that that was a process that was through college, and then after college it sort of culminated. And I was dealing with some depression at that point in time, and you don't necessarily have to look at porn when you're depressed, but it was an escape for me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't... it was sort of like a perfect storm, mm-hmm. you could say. And I sort of continued down that road for a while. And I need to say that during those times I knew it was wrong, and I easily rationalized my, you know, my reasons for doing that. But mainly I just did it without thinking. Satan doesn't want me to think about looking at anything. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want me to think at all. He just wants me to react mm-hmm. to how my body is feeling. And so when I did have those moments of thinking, that's when I was like, I need some accountability. Mm-hmm. And so I got some accountability. I was like, oh, I need to limit, you know, when I'm looking at the internet mm-hmm. and these boundaries, you know, that I started building for myself. But the main problem was that I didn't hate my sin. So Satan just used those boundaries against me to say that, listen, you're under the burden, you know, you are not free, you are a slave to your sin. So he would play judge and jury. He would be like, you need to do this, and then he'd condemn you the moment after. Mm-hmm. And so this weight that I couldn't get out from under continued as I grew into deeper into my sin.
And did you come to a point where, because I think so many of us believers do this, where Satan's talking to you, you recognize it as sin, like you said, you're, you know, there's kind of this euphoria associated with sure. it, then you have shame. Did you kind of at one point say, okay, I need to start dealing with this, I need to start, or I can eventually tackle it, or I'll eventually, like, you know, kind of that compartmentalization of, I can handle this eventually, I'm not going to let it get too far, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get, what was that process as far as, like, you know, because we so often talk about the supernatural need for Christ to be in our lives, but all mm-hmm. of us try to tackle sin on our own terms first.
Yeah. I had employed some accountability and that kind of thing, and I... you know, I did the best I could to be able to limit it myself. And those were very tangible things that I could do. But Satan seems to work from the outside in, where God moves from the inside out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to conquer my sin from the outside in, mm-hmm. you know, and setting up these barriers and that kind of thing. And so I was dealing with it, but I wasn't dealing with it appropriately. Mm-hmm. The frustration grew as my boundaries were that only. They were just boundaries, but I crossed them all the time because men, you know, if the speed limit's 80, then I'm going 86, mm-hmm. you know, and they were just things that I could beat, and that added to my euphoria. And my frustration then mm-hmm. grew to the point of desperation, like you were saying, and it came to a point where I'm just in my car driving, you know, I'm going to do some ministry event, you know, and I just am like in tears, like just pounding my steering wheel and just like, this, I am disgusting, you know, and I hate myself and I hate what I do. And Satan was just like, yeah, you know, you are, you know, you're off the deep end, you know, you have no hope. You might as well just go and live in a box mm-hmm. somewhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the times, there was multiple times, you know, two steps forward, one step back kind of areas where the desperation started to kick in, and I knew that there was something that I was missing. There was a variable that I was missing that I need to implement that would enable me to defeat this once and for all.
And I know that you've mentioned, Jesse, you've used the phrase spiritual fevers mm-hmm. and talked about what Steve Arterburn says in Every Man's Battle about spiritual fevers. And sure. how does that play into what you just described as hating your sin?
Well, I think that, you know, when we're sick, you know, obviously, if we're not bedridden, we can still go to work. You can still come and do a Boundless interview and do publicity work, and I can go and produce my show, but I really don't feel good. You know, I'm distracted, and I'm a little bit more angry than usual, more emotional than usual, but often I flatline a little bit, and I'm not able to be positive about the things that are good, and I'm not able to be angry about the things that, you know, are bad. You know, I sort of just am trying to survive, you know, and a spiritual fever does that, just that, with our passion for Christ, you know, and Him coming alive in our lives and our intimacy that we have with Him. It really destroys the very building blocks of allowing us to be close with Him. And He is alive in me, and He was alive in me then. And He, you know, and I know that in front of the Father, I'm washed clean, and that I'm, you know, I'm going to heaven someday, and I'm saved by grace. But because I had sin that I continued to allow to be in my life, I couldn't be close with Him, and because I was disobeying the truth that He had given me, and that translated into all tangible areas of my life. If I was giving counsel, or if I was I should have been upset with something that didn't make me upset at all, or I should have been excited about something. You know, even in my relationships, I think that this specific example really touches on that, is when, you know, if I had a friend that was really dealing with a spiritual issue, you know, I was seen even then as a little bit of you know, a guy that could be gone to for advice and that kind of thing about certain things and relationships. But I noticed that when I had those times of shame, especially, that I was absolutely exhausted to give any spiritual wisdom at all. It was terrible, because I knew that's what God has made me for, mm-hmm. but I couldn't deal with my sin and deal with the truth mm-hmm. at the same time. It just wore me out. Mm. And living a Christian life while having pervasive sin in my life that I allowed to continue to germinate in my life, mm-hmm. They didn't work together well. And therefore, I was just more tired. All those things mm-hmm. I can attribute to having a spiritual fever.
Mm. So obviously, you had to really go after this as sin, sure. which I think is actually a very empowering thing to a guy, yeah. because like you said, a battle, a challenge, you know, whatever, and rather than jousting at it with a pin or something like that, you need to lop it off with a sword. Sure. But so what, obviously, you know, we're talking about addressing this biblically and what God's role in that is and what it looks like to really have Christ as your first love and you know, knock porn or whatever it is. I mean, we're talking about any kind of addiction. It could be food. It could be sex. It could be shopping. I mean, this mm-hmm. is going to apply to everyone in that sense. Knocking that off the pedestal and moving forward in a way that that God is glorified in every decision you make. But you still put practical safeguards in place. And let's talk about how your life looks different now that mm-hmm. you're addressing porn actively in your life. How does your life look different than maybe someone in the average culture?
Well, there's two intangibles that I've had to grasp. First of all, like I had mentioned before, I've had to understand God's heart for sin. Mm-hmm. And I've had to understand that he hates it. He can't be in the presence of it. And if he is in me, then there needs to be no presence of sin in me. Along with that, I have to understand what I mean to the Lord. I need to understand what he has given to be with me his entire life. He was naked on that cross, vulnerable for me, and he died and rose again for me. I am valuable. I'm an heir to the throne. I'm a son of God, you know, and I need to understand that when those voices in my head come that I am despicable and despised by heaven, I can immediately put those aside and know that I am valuable to the King, even in my sin, and as well as being able to embrace the character of God that hates sin and that God died for it.
Yo, Boundless, this is Travis J. Williams, and I'm going to give a shout-out to episode 138. That episode was off the chain, off the hizzy, if you will. because not only did it strike up a serious conversation, but you had some serious comedy going on with J-Dog Jeremy Woodard. The dude was crazy, crazy. Awesome year for Boundless. Lisa, you're doing a great job. And thank you to all the Boundless listeners all around the world. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Peace.
This life is equal, no skins, dicks, and no sips of Patron. We got Jesus when they see us, they think we drunk, though. Probably cause I be wildin' and jumpin', screamin', I represent. Get drunk, throw it up, what's up, Jesus, you know we reppin' him. We were called and chosen when our heart was frozen, rollin' with Satan, man. Tryna trust in the lust and the flesh in the eyes, our pride was hatin', man. But our God is rich in mercy, mercy, great in love. We were dead in sin, but Christ bled for sin, and that's why he raised us up.
Well, hey everyone, this is Lisa Anderson, your host, here for this week's culture segment, and I had to bring along a guest host with me this time around because this is a big interview, folks, and this is going to be a fun time. And in order to do this, now you all know, when we talk to our guest here, you all know that I have said on Facebook and on this show and elsewhere that I really was probably meant to be black. And not that you know, the Lord didn't do what he needed to do with me or whatever, but I just sometimes feel like, just, I don't know, my ministry would just be more vibrant and more effective were I black, because I just feel like I have it in my heart, okay, even though I am Swedish. So I don't know what that's about. And Norwegian, maybe that makes me diverse. I'm both types of Scandinavian. But anyway, all that to say, I have a a deep affinity for hip-hop, rap, all this musical genre, okay? And we know this because I talk about it often, and I sing lyrics, and I do different things like that, and then I have to talk about mainstream rap and how I, you know, there's times when I've listened to some of that, and I have to bleep out certain things or do radio edits, and I'm like, seriously, what is even the point? I'm not even listening to any of the lyrics. So, anywho, so I had to bring in Travis Williams. Travis, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Lisa, for having me.
Travis is also, unfortunately, white. But
it's,
you know,
a little
what?
Secret.
It is a secret. So we are just two white people sitting in a studio here at Focus on the Family, getting ready to interview Lecrae. Lecrae is on the phone with us. Lecrae, welcome to the show.
Thank y'all. It's good to be here.
Okay,
good to have you on, Lecrae.
He is already laughing at us, which is awesome. He's very concerned about this interview, I can tell. He is in prayer right now. He has prayer warriors around him because he's concerned about what we're going to ask. But Travis and I were talking just before we went on the air, Lecrae, about how excited we are about your music and your ministry. And honestly, I couldn't even get Travis to shut up. So we're going to let him talk some here to you as well. But want to say, Lecrae is a Christian rapper. You are you like a co-founder of Reach Records? I know that's your label.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but really with a passion for the gospel and for evangelism and for communicating really in a, and this is a, my little moniker that I use here on the show, Lecrae, is don't mess with Lisa A because she don't play. Okay, I like putting it out there, and I like people who are hardcore, and you're hardcore, so you're already one of my BFFs. Okay. And obviously, though, I'm part of a large crowd because you have got over 21,000 followers on Twitter and 47,000 friends on Facebook, all of whom you've had over for dinner, I am sure, at some point at your home there in Atlanta.
You try.
You try. Could you please enter me into the rotation at some point? I would appreciate it.
Getting around to you.
Okay. Well, that's good. And we're going to talk about his music. You have, I'm assuming this new album that's coming out is still in the works. You just had a new single release called Far Away that we're excited about, obviously, about the tragedy in Haiti and what's gone on there and just the need for redemption and restoration in that area as well as around the world. But let's just go ahead and talk a little bit of history just to kick it off. We want to know basically the summary statement about Lecrae. How did you get started in this business? I mean, is it just obviously, you know, your story itself? I mean, I don't want to just say, you know, hey, anyway, so I was black, so I had to be a rapper. I mean, that's not,
right.
that's not okay. So we want to hear your true story about how this happened. So give us a little background.
You know, just as a kid, I loved music. I just grew up loving music and always wanted to have something to do with music. I was basically a latchkey kid, so I stayed at home a lot by myself. And so my television and I were like best friends. So anything on TV, you know, music, was just kind of my world. So it was either going to be an actor or some sort of musician. So that's just kind of what I've always been interested in. And so I guess as time moved on, I just, you know, would dibble and dabble in a little bit of music, a little bit of, you know, any type of arts I could get my hands on. I couldn't draw much, but I would try anything creative. I'd try my hand at it. So it just so happened that, you know, by the Lord's grace, I just ended up getting into a college on a performing arts scholarship, and it was also at that school that I, you know, became a Christian and was just wrestling that whole, you know, those whole few years there of how to combine my faith and my desire for creative arts together. And what you got is who I am now, is this rapper dude who loves the Lord and tries to use my gifts to put them on display. So that's the roundabout way that it happened for me. I just, you know, met a lot of great people in college and after college who kind of gave me opportunities, and I guess the word just spread. So.
That's great, Lecrae. One of the things that we noticed kind of is in Christian music, there always seemed to be a void in the hip hop. Now, there were some greats, you know, like Grits and maybe even, you know, on the rap scene, P.O.D. a little bit on the rap rock side of things. And then all of a sudden,
isn't that P.I.D.?
Or, yeah, Preachers in Disguise.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and P.O.D. did a little rap rock.
Oh, okay, that's old school.
Great. Old school. And then all of a sudden, I'm at the Christian bookstore and run into an artist, Lecrae, and it seemed like hip-hop just kind of, the Christian hip-hop scene has been booming in the last 3 to 5 years, partly in due to Reach Records. What kind of impact has your music had on people who maybe aren't believers?
Who are or not?
Well, maybe we'll look at both sides of the coin.
Yeah.
Because I think for believers, it opens up a whole different world as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that we definitely just try to, at Reach Records, is we try to be very cutting edge. So we fight very hard to be as culturally relevant as we possibly can, just in terms of what's going on out there. I mean, I grew up in hip-hop culture, so if it's terrible, it's terrible, you know, just regardless. If the music isn't good, it isn't good. So we fight hard to be as good as we can be with our music. And I think that's really shocked a lot of the non-Christian world is that, you know, because Christian rap has always had the stigma as being either cheesy or just terrible. You know, one of the two, is that the music is terrible or it's just cheesy. And so just to kind of play a role and break it down, that stigma, that stereotype, and to actually put something that sounds good out there has been powerful. So a lot of people have heard it and said, oh, wow, I thought this was going to be terrible. This is actually pretty good. And, you know, and for the believers, I think we're pretty catalytic. We you know, the whole Reach Records crew, myself, Trip Lee, Sho, Baraka, Tadashi, we're a bunch of clowns, but we're also very passionate people. And I think that's kind of contagious. And so it just, you know, it ignites people around the world.
You have definitely branched out and associated yourself with some folks that I think would just blaze some people away. They would be like, Lecrae, you got to be kidding me. I mean, you have fans among John Piper, Mark Driscoll. You actually used Mark Driscoll's voice in Rebel. I mean, you're hanging out with the reformers and just put, you know, with some of the Calvinists and some of the reform dudes. Obviously, you know, with songs like "Don't Waste Your Life," John Piper has a book by the same name. What's that been like? Just kind of getting to know some of them.
It's been a blessing. It really has to from one aspect, you know, to have hip hop and hip hop culture and urban culture. To actually be a spokesperson, you know, for that demographic, and then to be able to have a voice in, you know, the worlds of Piper and Driscoll to articulate what's going on in that world. And just because at the end of the day, it's not just, you know, the urban world that's influenced by it. It's the suburban world as well. You know, the urban world just trickles all the way into the suburbs. And so it affects what they do and who they want to reach and so on and so forth. So it's been an honor because these guys are incredible thinkers and processors, and so just to pick their brains on so much stuff. But then it's also been, you know, mind blowing that they would even ask me questions. And so, humble guys, appreciate it.
I feel it in my bones, and I just don't think I can hold it anymore. The river is rising, flowing out of me, and I'm coming alive. I'm coming alive. I'm gonna dance and sing and move my feet, 'cause the river is rising, flowing out of me. Gotta let the world know, take it to the streets. I'm gonna dance and sing and not a shout of praise.
Oh, well, that was some great stuff. I always love listening to clips and kind of thinking back on where I was and kind of the people in the studio and how I remember meeting them and how they expressed their views. And just it's kind of like doing the show. You meet a bunch of new friends. And so not only those guests that have come through and the people I've had on the roundtable, but also you out there in the audience who have been a part of this show as well throughout the year. So I hope you enjoyed this little trip down memory lane as much as I did and as much as Dave did, though he had to put it all together. So maybe his enjoyment was a little bit more. He had to maybe plan it out a little bit more, but that's okay. Anyway, we enjoyed it. We enjoy you. We love you here at Boundless. I hope you all have a very happy new year as we head into 2011. We'll have a whole new slate of shows for you coming up in the new year, a whole new bunch of challenges, and I hope that you will join us for those. So again, have a great week and weekend, and we will see you in 2011.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focus on the family.